Thank you very much for coming to the panel on immigration and the role of the states. My name is Carissa Hessick. I'm on the faculty at Arizona State University College of Law, and I'm very glad that you're all here to hear about this. Personally, immigration and the role of the states wasn't something that I thought much about until I moved to Arizona in 2007, which happened to coincide rather neatly with Arizona passing its employer sanctions law, which was just heard a challenge to that before the U.S. Supreme Court. Since then, of course, there's been SB 1070, which I like to think of as the sort of things that keeps law professors in Arizona in the newspaper and on the news. And now, of course, this past week, we had some legislation unveiled, this time not just Arizona. There are, of course, other states who are very involved in immigration reform, this time on citizenship for babies born to people who are in the country illegally. So we have a great panel for you today, two very distinguished speakers. We're going to speak for a bit, then they're going to have a chance to respond to each other, and then we'll open it to questions. Our first speaker will be Professor Jack Chin, who's on the faculty at my neighboring school, the University of Arizona's James E. Rogers College of Law, where he's the Chester H. Smith Professor of Law. And then we'll hear from John Eastman, who's at the Chapman University School of Law, where he's the Donald P. Kennedy Chair in Law and Dean Emeritus. So please help me in welcoming both of our speakers, and then we'll hear from Jack.
Thank you, Carissa, and thank all of you for coming. It's a real pleasure to be here. I would like to talk about the role of states in immigration enforcement through the lens of the work of Professor Chris Kobach, recently elected Secretary of State of Kansas, as many of you know. And he's the major academic architect of a set of ideas that I call the mirror image theory. And his proposition is that states can enact their own legislation relating to immigration so long as it mirrors federal law. He argues that the mirror image structure gets around preemption and allows states to participate in this way. And his work has had remarkable influence. At the legislative level, it's led to a number of statutes at the state level and in localities. And at the sort of political, public, popular culture level, it really has made an impact that's exemplified by the question, what could possibly be wrong with the state helping the federal government carry out its own law? And that question has been asked by such people as George Will, Sarah Palin, Rush Limbaugh. It's been articulated on the editorial pages of the New York Post and Washington Times. In the litigation over SB 1070, there was a remarkable amicus brief by 80 senators and representatives who basically said, why can't the states help the federal government carry out its own law? The mirror image theory played an important role in the SB 1070 litigation, too. Some parts of SB 1070 were enjoined, but not all. And immigration restrictionists are reading the decision, and I think with some justification, as an affirmation of the mirror image theory. So the judge in the U.S. District Court judge said, for example, that all SB 1070 does in the parts that she upheld are create parallel state statutory provisions for conduct already prohibited by federal law. This is mirror image theory talk. So I want to take a few minutes to explain why I believe that the mirror image theory doesn't work. The big point of SB 1070 is Section 1, and it explains what the law is designed to do. The legislature declares that the intent of this act is to make attrition through enforcement the public policy of all state and local government agencies in Arizona. The provisions of this act are intended to work together to discourage and deter the unlawful entry and presence of aliens and economic activity by persons unlawfully present in the United States. The key operational provision makes it a crime to knowingly transport, conceal, harbor, shield, or entice an undocumented person in furtherance of their unlawful presence in the United States. And this section is similar but not identical to a federal statute, 8 U.S.C. 1324. The narrow reading of the Arizona law is that it applies to the actual process of immigration and evading apprehension, actual crossing borders, avoiding the police. The broader implication, which I think is the one that was intended by the drafters, is that it covers almost every form of transportation within the state of Arizona, because driving someone else from their apartment to the supermarket to buy food and then driving them back is, in a certain sense, in furtherance of their unlawful presence in the United States. And I do believe that it was intended to be covered by the statute. So, as I say, the federal court in Arizona did not enjoin this provision. It's in effect in Arizona today. Similar statutes are on the books and enforced today in six other states. It's clear, in my view, as a matter of federal immigration law, that a state needs some kind of hook to make the statute viable. When states get involved in immigration, the statutes make clear that there's not simply a preemption question in the sense of whether a particular statute conflicts with some particular provision of federal law, but that there's an affirmative disability, an affirmative disablement on the parts of the states to regulate immigration. So here's what the court said in 1884 in a case called Edie versus Robertson. This court has distinctly decided, and frequently, that the power to regulate immigration does not belong to the states. That decision did not rest in any case on the ground that the state and its people were not deeply interested in the existence and enforcement of such laws and were not capable of enforcing them if they had the power to enact them, but on the ground that the Constitution and the division of powers which it declares between the states and the general government has conferred this power on the latter to the exclusion of the former. Professor Kobach solves this problem by claiming that mirror image enforcement is authorized by positive federal law. He claims that there's an affirmative delegation of authority to the states to do this. And he builds this in part from cases from the U.S. Court of Appeals. He writes, concurrent enforcement is clearly within a state's authority. As the Ninth Circuit in Gonzalez versus Peoria opined, where state enforcement activities do not impair federal regulatory interests, concurrent enforcement activity is authorized. Where federal and local enforcement have identical purposes, preemption does not occur. So there's a number of cases that he cites that have language to that effect, but it's not merely a rule that's derived from common law or a presumption that it's derived from common law. It's supported by statutes. In the words of the amicus brief filed in Arizona by the 80 senators and representatives, they say, Congress has passed numerous acts that welcome state involvement in immigration control. And so far as it goes, this authority is right. The cases that Professor Kobach talks about exist. The statutes exist. Here's the problem. All of the authority involves arrests. All of the ways that the common law and the statutes invite state participation in immigration enforcement involve arrests. So the issue is whether the power of a state to arrest, which clearly exists, at least to some extent, implies the power to legislate. And my argument is that it does not. And I derive this conclusion from things like citizens' arrest, from the National Crime Information Center, which is a nationwide database of warrants that allows a police officer in Idaho to make an arrest based on a warrant in Connecticut. I derive this from the federal statute that invites local law enforcement officers to make arrests of active duty military personnel for desertion. This and there are many other things, including cases, that suggest that arrest is a widely dispersed power that extends even to private citizens that does not in any way imply legislative authority. The fact that, for example, localities are invited to arrest Marines who desert their unit doesn't imply that localities are invited to pass some regulations for how Marines should behave, and if they do desert, they can put them in the local jail. It simply doesn't follow. There's another problem, and that is the text of the Immigration and Nationality Act, which doesn't say one way or another whether the states are there's no express preemption in the Immigration and Nationality Act. And yet the structure of it is so clearly aimed at giving authority to the federal agencies that I think that the implication is inescapable. One is that the text of the Immigration and Nationality Act says that the provisions are to be carried out by the Departments of Homeland Security, State, and Justice. doesn't mention any other agencies that are supposed to do it. The substance of the Immigration and Nationality Act, what it tells these people to do, these agencies to do, also, I think, leaves little room for an implication of state participation. And what I'm... So the substance of the immigration... When an undocumented non-citizen is found in the United States, the Immigration and Nationality Act provides a range of responses. Criminal prosecution, civil deportation, voluntary departure, civil money penalty. These are sanctions and ways of getting rid of the person. But it also provides a number of ways for an undocumented person who has no claim of lawful status whatsoever to stay. There's a relief provision called registry that allows people who've been in the United States for many years to simply be given lawful status. There's asylum. There's a number of visas that are available broadly to the types of people that we're talking about. There are visas for trafficked persons, and many of the undocumented people have been trafficked across the border by professional smugglers, crime victims, crime witnesses. So there's a formalized form of prosecutorial discretion called deferred action that allows the government, the federal government, just to say we're not going to deport you, and that can come with work authorization. So with all of the available mechanisms that are provided for by the Immigration and Nationality Act, even with regard to a completely undocumented person, I think there's no plausible support for the idea that another agency, another branch of government is invited to come in and help out and exercise some of these discretionary choices also. Well, why is arrest allowed? Isn't that inconsistent with my argument? Why can states robustly exercise the arrest power, which I concede that they can? And the answer is that when a locality makes an arrest of an undocumented person and turns them over to federal authorities, the federal authorities are free at that point to say anything from we're going to put you in prison to we're going to give you citizenship under some provision of the Immigration and Nationality Act. Arrest helps the federal government, doesn't tie their hands, but making a choice, like we're going to put you in prison when the agencies that the Immigration and Nationality Act actually confide that set of decisions to might say, we're going to do something else, I think that's a problem. Another little problem here is that historical point is that amnesty, widespread amnesty, has been a regular feature of federal immigration and policy. Since 1893, there have been six major amnesties and numerous, countless, smaller ones. And so at least as a historical matter, at least what Congress has done is regularly sort of given people a fresh start in this area. So I don't think that there's any serious argument that Congress has actually invited the states to help out in the way that SB 1070 is entering the immigration policy problem. It's really, in my opinion, not a plausible claim. However, there's a very interesting historical dynamic here, which is over a century old. And that is, we see aggressive state interventions in immigration, federal invalidation, and then a political response. Then Congress comes in and says, you know, we get why the states were concerned here, or why one state was concerned here, and we're going to do something. We're going to meet halfway. We're going to provide some kind of policy response. So it's certainly not out of the question. I would wager that it's a certainty that there'll be some action, at least in one house, on immigration. But it's not out of the question at all to me that Congress could pass a law that said, we hereby make the law of the land Chris Kobach's mirror image theory. And so I don't think they've done that yet. But it's not beyond the realm of political speculation that they could. In that event, would it be constitutional? And my answer is no. I don't think that they could do it. I don't think that Congress could authorize states to pass their own mirror image statutes. At least I have grave doubts about it. And I get this from moss-covered dicta from ancient cases, but I think that they're justified by modern principles. One is that states do not have a sufficient sovereign interest in immigration to regulate the area. There's an 1816 case called Martin versus Hunter's lessee, where the Supreme Court said, no part of the criminal jurisdiction of the United States can, consistently with the Constitution, be delegated to state tribunals. And so I don't think, at least to the extent that we're talking about an exclusive federal power, such as immigration is, I don't think that even Congress could say, the Constitution has given this authority to us exclusively, but we want you to have it. We're green-lighting it. I get this from things like Plyler versus Doe, where the majority said the state has no direct interest in controlling immigration to this country, that interest being one reserved by the Constitution to the federal government. And the dissenters who disagreed with what the case was about, Justices O'Connor, Rehnquist, Berger, and White, thought that Texas could deny K through 12 education to undocumented non-citizens. But on the core point, they agreed. A state has no power, they said, to prevent unlawful immigration and no power to deport illegal aliens. Those powers are reserved exclusively to Congress and the executive. There's an old Lochner-era case called Knickerbocker Ice versus Stewart, where the court says Congress cannot transfer its legislative authority to the states. By nature, this is non-delegable. Of course, non-delegation doctrine is in some disrepute these days, but I think the rationale of the line item veto case, Clinton versus New York, which is a modern case, would bring us to the same conclusion. Decanis versus Bica, a 1976 case that said that California could restrict the employment of non-citizens, did recognize that there was a category of constitutionally proscribed regulation of immigration that Congress itself would be powerless to authorize or approve on behalf of the states. So I think that that there would be a problem in authorizing states to do things like SB 1070. There's a difference between Congress, as it can do, drawing a line in areas of shared authority, like taxation, like imposition of taxation or regulation of commerce. Obviously, there's going to be some state authority in those areas and some federal authority, and Congress can come in and say, you know what, we're going to give you a little more room, states, so go ahead and do it. I think there's a difference between that and a power that exclusively belongs to the federal government that the states have no share in. There's also a separation of powers problem. Tennessee versus Davis, another one of my favorite antique cases. There can be no criminal prosecution, the Supreme Court said, initiated in any state court for that which is merely an offense against the general government. So I don't think that the federal government can authorize state prosecutors as such to prosecute federal cases or federal crimes, or crimes which are crimes only because of a donation of federal authority. Federal prosecution clearly is an executive activity. It's the president's business. And I don't think that it can be delegated to somebody who's completely out of the presidential chain of command. State prosecutors are not appointed, supervised, or removable by the president. And so under the second holding in Prince, even under Morrison versus Olson and under the Peekaboo case, I think that that there's a separation of powers problem. Congress would be, in that instance, giving federal executive power to the states, can't do it. Only the president has the right to execute federal law. If you want to appoint state prosecutors, special assistant U.S. attorneys, and put them in the chain of command so that there's some form of supervision, I don't think that there's a problem with that. But if what you're saying is, hey, you state prosecutors, do whatever you want, we are not going to pay attention. You exercise your judgment, and whatever you want to do is fine. I don't think that that's permissible under the Constitution. Well, I'm sure I'm running out of time or over time, so I'll stop with that. Thanks.
I find myself in a great deal of agreement with Professor Chin as far as it goes. If this was an isolated context of immigration arena only, then I would agree with everything. In fact, I think he has pointed to a dilemma that Justice Scalia is going to have when this case comes up there, and that is his language in Prince about not allowing private actors to enforce federal law, the lack of the chain of command, the presidential, the unitary executive theory. I'm glad you've adopted the unitary executive theory here that came from that. I think, though, for Scalia, there's a way out of that, and I think it's by recognizing that our entire body of law in this area is not Hines versus Davidovits and derivative cases, but that's one end of a spectrum that has on its other end not the line from DeCanis that you quoted, but the holding from DeCanis. And that is that, yes, Congress has plenary power over federal immigration policy, but the states have a police power. And DeCanis tells us that in the exercise of that police power, they can regulate things even that have collateral impact in core immigration arenas, the hiring and employment relationship of illegal immigrants in that case, because of its police power impact in the state that made tried to regulate that. And so I don't think you can exclude the police power angle from this in assessing the authority of the states here. And once you accept that there are police powers that the states have that overlap in many ways with the federal immigration authority, you find that there's a great deal that the states can do. And I think that's where the conversation is. Because then it turns it not from an exclusive preemption discussion because of plenary powers in Congress, but one that has to be an explicit preemption. And it shifts the burden, and the court in DeCanis recognized this, that we have a presumption against preemption, and so we've got to have explicit or express preemption in order to intrude on the state's police powers. Because the other flaw in looking at it the other way is the notion that unless there's a specific authorization for the states to act in this arena, they cannot do so. But that's not the constitutional structure we have. Yes, it would be true in order to have the states act as immigration agents, they would have to have an explicit power. And I haven't given a lot of thought on whether that's a non-delegable power or not. I may agree with you. It may well be. But the states don't derive their power to act in the exercise of their police powers from the federal Constitution, and they therefore don't have to have an explicit grant of authority from the Congress in order to exercise their police powers. And so the question is SB 1070 and other similar efforts an exercise of the police power that targets the collateral impact caused by illegal immigration or the federal government's failure to adequately enforce congressional policy? And here I think one of the most interesting aspects of the SB 1070 litigation that the Department of Justice brought is the bit of an incoherence in the argument that they have to actually kind of tweak the language of cases that they're citing to stand for slightly different propositions than the cases actually say. The cases are full of things like the Congress has plenary power over immigration because of its Article 1, Section 8 power over naturalization. Well, that in the complaint and in the briefing by the Department of Justice becomes not Congress with plenary power, but the federal government with plenary power. And then it says that, you know, the article, the Constitution assigns the authority over nationalization exclusively to the federal government, forgetting that it's actually there in Article 1, not in Article 2. And then the decision not to enforce or the extent to which to enforce becomes the plenary power rather than the policy judgments actually made by Congress. And, of course, that turns the fact that what Arizona is doing actually furthering the policy judgments made by Congress rather than the non-enforcement judgment of the executive kind of turns the plenary power source of authority on its head. And so then we're back to whether the state is able to do this when it is in furtherance of the policy judgments made by the author or the source of that plenary power, Congress, but in exercise of a separate police power. And I think if you look at the provisions of the Arizona law, and also some of the key concessions made by Judge Bolton in the opinion, you find that most of this, I think, should be upheld. And one of the big provisions, of course, is the Section 2, the verify, requiring officers to verify. And this, quite frankly, is one of the holdings of the trial court decision that I find most perplexing. But it's the one that got the most attention, you know, requiring the officers to verify any time they have a reasonable suspicion that somebody is unlawfully present in the United States. Now, what escaped most of the news coverage on that holding invalidating or preliminary enjoining that provision of the law was footnote 12, in which Judge Bolton herself concedes that law enforcement already has the discretion to verify immigration status when they have a reasonable suspicion that somebody is here unlawfully present. And the notion that we can concede that they can do that as a matter of discretion, but that the state can't, in the exercise of its police powers, dictate to its own officers how that discretion is going to be exercised, is a rather bizarre position, it seems to me, for Judge Bolton and the Department of Justice to be in. Either the local law enforcement could never make that inquiry, or the discretion can clearly be cabined by their bosses to either exercise it fully or never exercise it, as Arizona decides. You can't have it both ways, it seems to me, in any coherent way, and yet that's what they do. There are some other interesting aspects of the litigation that I think create some coherent tension, both in the kinds of attacks that the Department of Justice waged and in the holding. So let me just kind of go through a quick summary of what of the provisions that were not enjoined by Judge Bolton. There's a prohibition on interfering of local officials interfering with the enforcement of federal law. This is the anti-sanctuary city provision, and a requirement, in fact, of those local officials to cooperate with the enforcement of federal law. And allowing citizen suits to be brought against the city officials for violating either of those provisions. None of those were enjoined. They weren't even challenged by the Department of Justice. There's a crime, state law crime, of stopping day laborers if they impede traffic. That one seems to be fairly covered by the exercise of police power. Traffic is a vintage police power, and therefore clearly permissible under Decanus. It wasn't challenged by the Department of Justice and therefore not reached by Judge Bolton. The knowing employment of illegals and new requirements for checking eligibility. Those seem to be kind of vintage immigration consequences that are not challenged by the Department of Justice and therefore aren't enjoined by the opinion. There's another state law crime for transporting or harboring illegal immigrants. This was challenged by the Department of Justice. And there's another provision impounding the vehicles used in the transportation. And that was challenged by the Department of Justice. Neither of those were enjoined by Judge Bolton. And I don't see how you can not enjoin those and then reach the other parts of the opinion that were enjoined, which is the requirement that officers verify, a state law crime for failure to carry immigration papers that are required by federal law, the state law crime to solicit work, and arrest if there was a plausible cause. So I think there's some internal tension or incoherence in the opinion that that I suspect the Court of Appeals will start to work out. And I don't know whether we're going to end up with just the panel decision. My guess is we might get an en banc decision out of the Ninth Circuit before it goes up to the Supreme Court. But I do think this is headed to the Supreme Court. But again, I think the proper way to think of it is as Hines versus Davidovitz and Decanus is kind of two opposite ends of a spectrum of state authority and federal authority. Hines talks about when you're acting only in the exercise of immigration policy, states are not part of that game. But if the states are exercising police powers, even if they have collateral impact, even if the purpose is because of the collateral impact of the immigration law, I think DeCanis tells us they can do that because they have the ultimate authority, not derived from the federal constitution, but derived from their own, to regulate the health, safety, welfare, and morals of the people within the state. Now, I want to turn then briefly to this week's news, because I think it's a fascinating additional part of the conversation about state authority. Having been at the press conference on Wednesday, and actually a co-author of the strategy that was developed, I can speak with some authority on what was done, and I can also tell you that it's not remotely like what you've read in most of the newspapers about it this week. So here's the question. I think it's fair to say that the Supreme Court has never held whether or not the children of temporary visitors or those who are unlawfully present in the United States are citizens under the Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment. Never held that. It has in dicta claimed that to be the case, Plyler versus Doe and the INS case, relatively recently, in dicta in Wong Kim Ark in 1898, you might be seen as suggesting that. But the holding of Wong Kim Ark in 1898 involved the child of a lawful permanent resident. And to that extent, you can't be seen as repudiating two prior cases, Slaughterhouse dicta, and Elk versus Wilkinson in 1884, both of which held that the second half of the citizenship clause that requires not just birth on U.S. soil, but being subject to the jurisdiction of the United States in order to claim this guarantee of automatic citizenship that the 14th Amendment provides, requires something more than merely partial or territorial jurisdiction. It requires instead the complete allegiance-owing type of jurisdiction. And that particular question has never been confronted by the court in a holding, and now with the illegal immigration question, it is being confronted. So the question was, is there a legal strategy, a legislative strategy that can be designed to force the legal issue into the courts to get the Supreme Court to weigh in on that? And what was launched this past week was, in fact, a three-part legislative strategy to press just that question. Now, I'm not going to make any predictions on whether my reading of the 14th Amendment, which I'll describe here in a moment, or some other reading of the 14th Amendment is ultimately going to prevail in the Supreme Court. I just want it resolved so we know whether, if we're going to take on this issue, it's got to be done by constitutional amendment or it can be done by statutory efforts. So the three-part strategy is this. The 14th Amendment reads that all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. So part one is state statutes saying that, okay, the 14th Amendment has a separation between United States citizenship and state citizenship. They both have to meet the same criteria, but we've got to know what that criteria is in order to recognize or not who are state citizens. We know how to decide who resides here. We've got that in other parts of our state statutes, a domicile and what have you. But we don't know what subject to the jurisdiction means, and so we're going to pass a statute that defines what we think the 14th Amendment subject to the jurisdiction clause means. And so part one is, for purposes of this statute, you are a citizen of Arizona, Kansas, Oklahoma, Missouri. I think there may be 14 or 15 states that end up doing this. If you were born or naturalized in the United States and are subject to the jurisdiction thereof, parallel language from the 14th Amendment. And then subsection 2 says, subject to the jurisdiction thereof means the child of citizens or lawful permanent residents, where one of the parents is a citizen or a lawful permanent resident, owing allegiance to the United States and or to no other sovereign, drawing on the specific language that was used by the authors of the 14th Amendment when they were asked this very question not in the context of illegal immigration, because there wasn't any, largely, at the time, but in the context of Native Americans. Would this require citizenship for Native Americans, for Indians, to use the term that they used in 1866 and 68? And Howard and Trumbull and others said, no, what we mean by that is complete jurisdiction, not temporary or territorial. And to define that in ways that most people can understand, imagine a tourist from Great Britain here on vacation. When they come into the United States, they are subject to our territorial jurisdiction. They have to comply with our laws while they're here. They drive on the right side of the road, not on the wrong side, the left side of the road. All right, but they don't owe allegiance to the United States. They can't be drafted into our army. They can't be prosecuted for treason if they take up arms against us. We can incarcerate them. We can treat them as an enemy combatant if they end up at, you know, if their nation ends up at war with us. But we can't prosecute them for treason while they're here because they hadn't an allegiance to us. And it's that difference between this partial or territorial jurisdiction, which is not what the 14th Amendment specifies, and the broader or whole or complete jurisdiction that they meant. And they said so with respect to the Native Americans, but I think the principle applies equally here as well. And so we take that those conversations, those colloquies from the floor of the Senate by the authors, which, you know, normally we treat as the definitive ruling. And, you know, it's hard to trace through how much of this was taken up in the ratification debates, which would be where the real authority would be. But generally, everybody understood that what they were doing was constitutionalizing the 1866 Civil Rights Act, which more clearly said all persons born here and not subject to any foreign power. The twist in language had nothing to do with changing the meaning. It had to do with trying to reconcile whether Indian tribes were foreign powers or domestic sovereign powers. And that was the extent of the reason for the change in language. So we think we've got a pretty good argument to make that originally the subject of the jurisdiction clause meant this broader jurisdiction. And then it goes on to say, no other benefits will flow from this. We're just trying to define state citizenship consistent with the 14th Amendment so we know what it means. Prong two of the attack is a multi-state compact. To the extent that Jack's right, that this is an exclusive preserve of the federal government, although I think, you know, Slaughterhouse tells us there's a difference between U.S. and state citizenship, right? So I don't think it carries over there. But we have a multi-state compact where the states will agree to any state joining in the compact that they will apply this definition of subject to the jurisdiction in acknowledging on a birth certificate whether someone born in that state's on that state's soil meets that test or does not meet that test. And so there'll just be a box. Are they subject to the jurisdiction of the United States upon birth, meeting the test set out in the other statute, or are they not? And so that another state receiving your birth certificate will now know that it signifies not just birth on U.S. soil, but birth on U.S. soil and being subject to the jurisdiction such that it is also demonstrative of citizenship. And that compact takes effect only upon ratification by Congress. Interesting question on whether that ratification vote has to be passed by law with presentment to the president. The text of the Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution suggests that it does not need to be presented to the president. And then the third piece of the strategy was introduced the next day in Congress by Representative King, which is basically a federal statutory proposal to define U.S. citizenship in the same way that the state proposals defined it, subject to the jurisdiction being a second required element in addition to birth on U.S. soil, and then what that means. And so I'd venture to guess that one or more or all three of those strategies will be quickly challenged in court. But then we have the court review of this question on what subject to the jurisdiction of the 14th Amendment meant. And whether the states, whether there is a question that whether by statute you can remove this magnet for illegal immigration, which when you think about it, and then I'll close with this, when you think about it, all of these magnets to illegal immigration contribute to undermining Congress's plenary power to have a policy on legal immigration that is one deliberated on what the priorities ought to be rather than one that, you know, who cuts in line first and most vigorously. And so if you want to look at it that way, all of this is part of the strategy to foster an enhanced legal immigration policy, one by design and deliberation, rather than by raw will of those that were not part of the deliberative process in the first place. And so I'll close with this. Jack said the immigration restrictionists use that phrase. It's not the right phrase. It's not immigration restrictionists, it's illegal immigration elimination and fostering of legal immigration so that the policy judgments of Congress, where the plenary power is assigned, get fully vindicated rather than undercut through the various illegal routes that we've eye-winked for way too long. Thanks very much.
So we're going to have both of our speakers respond briefly to each other, and then we'll open it up to questions. So start getting your questions ready.
So I think we agree. There's a number of points of agreement here. We agree that under the Equal Protection Clause, undocumented non-citizens are not a suspect classification, and therefore they're subject to rational basis review. We agree that the states have police power and sometimes can exercise that in ways that affects non-citizens, including in negative ways, and I think putting some of the cases together, they can exercise that police power in areas where they have it, even if an incidental effect is to drive out non-citizens. And so whether I think this is wise or unwise, or I have no question that a state could say, we are going to, no state dollars can be spent for health care for undocumented non-citizens, no state dollars can be spent for higher education for non-citizens. Those things are fine as a constitutional matter, regardless of, independently of the question of their wisdom as policy. I suspect that we would also both agree that the states do not have the authority to determine who is to be admitted to the United States, who is to be removed, or the conditions upon which lawful non-citizens can remain. And so the question here is, okay, they can. The states have police power, but the states can't regulate immigration. What is the police power interest here in laws like SB 1070? What exactly is the traditional state concern that is violated when there's a car with a licensed driver and there's some person in the car and they're driving within the limit and the car is registered and they're observing all the traffic signs and they drive to a Safeway and they buy some food and they put it in the trunk of the car and then they drive home. What is the police power interest of the state in saying, well, that passenger was undocumented and we don't want that passenger to be able to eat food that was bought at the Safeway? And what I have a hard time identifying in this round of SB 1070 type legislation and other similar things is the police power interest that's independent of the desire to get these people to leave. It seems to me that it's trying to squeeze into a police power rationale really regulation of immigration, and I don't think it quite works. I mean, you could say, of course, the states have police power to regulate the roads and the sidewalks, and you could say no one who's not documented can use the roads and sidewalks, because we want to save the money, the wear and tear, but I don't think that it quite works. The second thing, there's this discussion about discretionary enforcement, and I have two things to say about that. That this is a response to the federal government's failure to enforce immigration law. Well, immigration crimes are the number one crime of prosecution in federal courts in the United States. Three of the four largest federal criminal justice agencies, the Department of Homeland Security, Border Patrol, and the Bureau of Prisons, are immigration related. There's an unprecedented number of deportations and removals in the United States. The I-9 employment system works that requires verification of eligibility to work to be employed works well in large swaths of the economy. So I deny that that immigration has gone completely unenforced. It's gone largely unenforced in certain and in terms of removal of people, undocumented non-citizens or documented non-citizens who are convicted of crimes. That is a very high priority of state and local and federal law enforcement agencies. So large parts of the immigration system are aggressively enforced. One area isn't aggressively enforced, and that is non-criminal, low-level workers, agricultural workers. I think that one can say that that's, we have a ton of laws that are not systematically enforced. I can't think of one law that's enforced across the board. Very few laws, other than against rape, robbery, and murder, where this is an effort at 100% enforcement. And so it seems to me that if we pull aside, if we remove the politics from the question, then it's a perfectly reasonable enforcement strategy. We're going to deport the criminals. We're going to save the best jobs for people who are United States citizens or lawfully permitted to work, and we're going to make some other economically rational decisions about enforcement. A word or two about who gets to decide. This argument from Dean Eastman that that it's not up to the executive to make these policy choices about immigration, that immigration is indeed a plenary federal power, but it's one that's assigned primarily to Congress. I just don't think that that's true. I don't think that that is consistent with the history. Knopf versus Shaughnessy, a 1950 case, the Supreme Court says, when Congress prescribes a procedure concerning admission of aliens, it is not dealing alone with a legislative power. It is implementing an inherent executive power. And the Supreme Court has consistently said that immigration is closely tied to national security, closely tied to foreign policy, and therefore executive decisions have to be given a fairly significant degree of leeway. Justice Scalia in Reno versus Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee was a case where the Supreme Court said that people being deported cannot challenge their deportation on the ground of selective prosecution. They say this has to be left to the feds, to the executive. What will be involved in deportation cases, says the court, is not merely the disclosure of normal domestic law enforcement priorities and techniques, but often the disclosure of foreign policy objectives and, in this case, foreign intelligence products and techniques. The executive should not have to disclose its real reasons, and even if it did disclose them, a court would be ill-equipped to determine their authenticity and utterly unable to determine their adequacy. So the Supreme Court has recognized that in this area of prosecutorial discretion, in particular, beyond the prosecutorial discretion they enjoy in less important areas like criminal law, the executive has to be allowed to charge or not charge. Because if they aren't allowed to deport somebody who needs to be deported, then it could create a national security problem. If they are forced to deport someone, that the Immigration and Nationality Act says it's up to you to decide, but the state gets to overrule that. The federal government doesn't want to deport someone for national security or foreign policy reasons, but the state says, well, we do. We want them to go. So thanks for your input, Mr. President, but, you know, we're going to have to agree to disagree on this, and the person is deported. There's 150 years of this Supreme Court doctrine that says this is closely tied to foreign policy. So I think the tradition would say they get to, it's not only the ordinary tradition of prosecutorial discretion, it's a heightened one that I would be surprised if the court interfered with. One word on the birthright citizenship thing. What struck me as odd about this, and has always struck me as odd about this, and is that there's a statute at stake here. The Nationality Act of 1940, in my opinion, codifies the holding, the dicta of Wong Kim Ark versus United States. And the Nationality Act of 1940 seems to say to be a grant by Congress of citizenship to people who are born here and are not children of soldiers in hostile occupation or children of foreign diplomats. And it may be that Wong Kim Ark, the dicta was wrong. Maybe. I don't think so, but it may be. But no one questions that Congress has the right to give citizenship to whoever it wants, and it did. So it seems to me that this effort to challenge Wong Kim Ark and say, you know, this is wrong. Step one for people who support this is repeal the Nationality Act in 1940. And then you can worry about whether Wong Kim Ark was rightly decided. Thank you.
Oh, we're getting more areas of agreement then. I agree if Congress wanted to extend birthright citizenship beyond the floor that the Constitution sets out in the 14th Amendment, it can do so under its Article 1, Section 8 power over naturalization. If it wanted to give citizenship to everybody born here without regard to the subject to the jurisdiction clause, it could do that. And in fact, by claiming that the Nationality Act of 1940 does that, I think you concede my point that the floor of the constitutional 14th Amendment is where I think it is, that Congress has decided to go beyond that. Of course, the Nationality Act of 1940 does actually not go beyond the floor. All it does is use the exact language from the 14th Amendment. It just says all persons born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens, and then it has these exceptions for the marauding armies. But the language it uses is exactly the same language from the 14th Amendment, so it doesn't add anything for us on what the subject of the jurisdiction clause actually means. And so I think it remains an open question whether those who are not completely subject to the jurisdiction, either by being the child of a citizen parent or of a permanent lawful resident parent, are nevertheless citizens by virtue of merely being born on U.S. soil, effectively writing out the subject of the jurisdiction clause. The other questions about presidential discretion and the overlap with diplomatic affairs are extremely interesting, and in fact are the subject of the brief that the United States of Mexico filed in the SB 1070 case. That we need to rely on commitments made by the federal government executive in our diplomatic negotiations, apparently about non-enforcement policies. What colors it, though, is not the old cases that Jack cited, but the most recent case dealing with executive discretion in the area of foreign affairs when it interacts with state exercise of police powers. And the discretion is not nearly as complete as Jack's conveyed, and that case is the Medellin case. If the president does have such authority under his executive powers from Article 2 because of the diplomatic or international relations, they have to be exercised in a more formal way than just policy judgments made by some line official. They have to be made by executive order at the very least, and Medellin suggests even maybe by act of Congress more explicitly. And none of that exists here, which means that this just kind of rank-and-file prosecutorial discretion on to enforce or not enforce the federal immigration laws to the extent that it intrudes on state police power really does raise a huge Medellin problem. And I think the court on Medellin says that there's not that kind of discretion. You've got to be more formal. You've got to be more explicit with what you're setting out to do. Now, nobody is claiming that the states themselves can deport illegal immigrants that have been caught up in the net of SB 1070. What SB 1070 does is, in fact, hand them over to federal authorities, where that exercise of discretion is going to remain to the same extent as if the federal line officer had made the initial arrest themselves. And if in the exercise of that discretion at that point, the Department of Justice or Department of Homeland Security thinks that that they do not need to make the deportation, then they need to be more formal and say taking advantage of one of these other mechanisms for allowing somebody to stay in the United States, now lawfully or pseudo-lawfully, as the case may be. But that it's made clear rather than done by indecision, what have you. And I think what SB 1070 does is going to force the federal government to actually take a stand, whether in any individual instance we think this is a deportable offense, what have you, or a non-deportable offense, that we're going to give, you know, the I-9 visa or the U visa or whatever to. And that's as it should be. That's not the states intruding on that part of the immigration policy. And here's why the real the crux of why the state, I think, has the police power to do this. There are diplomatic reasons why the president may choose not to make deportations or what have you, why Congress has given that level of delegation to them. But there are also a series of interests, and I want to use the example that Jack raised. What state police power interest is implicated by somebody who is just lawfully riding along as a passenger with a licensed driver in a licensed car to go buy groceries at the store and go home, and they're not violating any traffic laws? I mean, under the Arizona statute, they're probably not getting stopped anyway. But if they get stopped for something else, the crime of transporting would be implicated. And what possible police power interest, independent of simply getting the people to leave, could there be? And the answer is this, that whether they're correct or incorrect in this, and it's a disputed factual question, the legislature of Arizona has determined that the volume of illegal immigration into Arizona is causing harm on their ability to deliver social services to the people of the state of Arizona. And taking enforcement actions that remove that threat to their ability to deliver social services to the people of Arizona is a vintage exercise of the state's police power. That they do it directly with if I have a reasonable suspicion that you've been, that you are here unlawfully, or whether they do it indirectly by removing the facility of you getting around and operating while you're here unlawfully, which is what the transportation requirement is. Those are just one step removed from the police power concern, and I think perfectly valid. Certainly in the states, I think it would be a valid necessary and proper to clause argument where we hold the nexus a little bit tighter at the federal level. We don't have such a tight nexus at the state level in the exercise of their police power. And we don't require that they be right in their assessment that the illegal immigration population is causing a drain on social services in Arizona. We don't even require, as we do at federal law, well, maybe we do under due process, that there at least has to be some reasonable basis for them thinking this, whether they're right or not. But I think that's a test that you easily get over. And these collateral ways to address it, I think, are vintage exercises of the police power. Okay, I think it's time to open up for questions. Thanks.
Great. So if you can just raise your hands, anyone with a question? Ilya, we'll start with you.
It only occurred to me listening to this debate today, so I didn't think of it in previous discussions of the law, but it seems to me that there's, in addition to the immigration power questions, there's also a dormant commerce clause question in that the Supreme Court has held that states are not allowed to regulate interstate commerce, and of course the same presumably applies to international commerce. In fact, the court has said that in the Burma case that Massachusetts does not have the power to impose its own trade sanctions on Burma, even with respect to the purchase of goods and services by the state government itself. And regulation of migration, I think, is very similar, at least in a case of economic migrants, which most of these people are, that this would be an example of Arizona attempting to restrict the migration of labor across international lines. And indeed, as if I understand, that's actually one of the justifications they themselves have cited. These people are competing with native-born citizens or whatnot for jobs. So just as Massachusetts cannot impose trade sanctions on Burma to protest Burma's policies or to protect Massachusetts companies against competition with Burmese companies, so similarly, it would seem to me that under the dormant international commerce clause, Arizona cannot impose restrictions on the migration of labor, and that I think is true even if the federal government has itself imposed similar restrictions. After all, there were federal trade sanctions on Burma, but Massachusetts chose to go beyond those, and I think the same point applies here with Arizona, that they have chosen to restrict the migration of labor to a greater extent, at least in the sense of using more law enforcement resources than the federal government has done. And so it seems to be the situation is similar. Now, I must admit I haven't studied this litigation closely, so it's possible that there's an angle that I'm missing. It's even possible there's some dormant commerce clause precedent that I'm missing. If so, I rely on the panelists to set me straight.
Well, you said along the way, I think, the answer to your own question, and that is that Massachusetts went beyond what the federal government had done. Pennsylvania, in the Hines versus Davidovich case, went beyond what the federal government had done, and those were held unconstitutional to the extent they went beyond. Arizona has mirrored what the federal government did. And here's what Judge Bolton says in rejecting the Dormant Commerce Clause challenge that the Department of Justice brought. The Department of Justice doesn't explain how the Arizona law, which creates parallel state statutory provisions for conduct already prohibited by federal law, has a substantial effect on interstate commerce. Footnote, it just criminalizes specific conduct already prohibited by federal law. And since the Dormant Commerce Clause is an implication from the absence of federal law, when you have a federal law and all of this is doing is paralleling it, you don't have a Dormant Commerce Clause thing, it seems to me. That's even accepting the legitimacy of Dormant Commerce Clause stuff, which, you know, is a different panel altogether. That's right. And if Arizona was adding additional requirements for migration into Arizona, the Massachusetts-Burma case talks about Massachusetts doing things that went beyond what federal government had done. The current Commerce Clause doctrine does not talk about state actions that mirror identically what the federal government has done. I think Judge Bolton's right about that. Where I think she's wrong in other parts of the opinion is that she didn't apply that same analysis there to the other parts.
I think there's a dormant foreign commerce clause problem and a dormant commerce clause problem in the sense that what Arizona is trying to do is to impose the costs of undocumented immigration onto other states. I think the logical consequence of this policy is not that people return to Mexico, it's that they go to Colorado, New Mexico, and California. But I guess I'd prefer to think of it less in dormant commerce clause or dormant foreign commerce clause terms and more in terms of looking at the parts of the Constitution that affirmatively say that this is not up to the states to deal with these areas. I'm thinking of Article 1, Section 10. There's a number of provisions, the jurisdictional provisions of Article 3, that make clear that the Constitution doesn't really trust the states to deal with non-citizens systematically, or at least that there has to be uniform policy across the United States when we're talking about non-citizens. And in my mind, I do think that there is doctrinal reality to your Dormant Commerce Clause observations, but I think the larger point is whatever happens here, it should be dealt with systematically, not state by state.
But let me press that a little bit, because earlier you conceded that the states could cut off education benefits or health benefits to illegal immigrants. And so the question is whether they can take other actions that are designed to have the same effect, such as locating those illegal immigrants and handing them over to the Department of Justice for deportation or other action the Department of Justice thinks is appropriate, when the purpose is to get a handle on the benefits that are going to illegal immigrants that are causing a drain on the social services provided by the state. Because when you concede the first point, I think you necessarily have to accept that it's within this exercise of the state's police power on the second. And then let me press the issue on what they're doing is passing the cost of this illegal immigration off, not back to Mexico, but to another state. In order to press that hypothetical, you've got to ask this question. If all 50 states adopted SB 1070, so that there wasn't an interstate transfer of the costs of illegal immigration, would it be permissible? And if you take that piece off the table, I think the answer has to be yes, if you accept the connection between their valid police power interests.
7 states have enacted something like SB 1070, and every one of those statutes differs in material ways, and none of them is identical to the federal statute. And so we still have inherent non-uniformity in this policy direction. On the other hand, I do think that when we're talking about state benefits, that there is also inherent non-uniformity.
Right.
Because because there's inherent non-uniformity, if Massachusetts has a general assistance program that's not temporary aid to needy families, it's something above and beyond that, if they make it available to non-citizens who are undocumented, it's going to be non-uniform. If they don't make it available to undocumented non-citizens, it's going to be non-uniform. It's inherently non-uniform because it's a Massachusetts-only program. So there, I don't think it's an issue. And I think we agree. I mean, I think partly because of this non-uniformity thing and because of the limited nature of arrest, and leaving aside my policy doubts about the wisdom of it, I think that if the state wanted to say we're going to close every other thing that we do in our state, from education to highways, and we're going to hire police exclusively, and we're going to donate them to the 287G program, which allows them to help carry out federal immigration law under the supervision of the Department of Homeland Security, I don't think that would be unconstitutional. If states want to do that, I think they can do it. Why? Because it leaves the ultimate decision-making authority in the hands of the federal government, where the Constitution and the Immigration and Nationality Act say it belongs. So, so I'm not particularly troubled on a legal, constitutional level by arrests. But that's not what's going on in SB 1070. What's going on with SB 1070 is this: if you are in a car on the road, then you can go to prison. That's the stick here, and that's designed to say to people who are undocumented, you have two choices. You can go to Colorado, or you can be subject to imprisonment in Arizona. And to me, that's the equivalent of saying, if we catch you, we're going to throw you out. It's a disguised way of doing that, but it's to me, not different.
Next question.
There's a third way, in which is not to come here illegally in violation of federal law in the first place.
But what you're saying is that the states then, SB 1070, is designed to help enforce federal law, and I don't think that they're invited to do that. Sorry.
I see no reason why not. I see it as a matter of sovereignty. If the federal government can make it illegal to violate foreign law, which it does all the time, I see no reason why states can't exercise their sovereign authority to make it illegal to violate federal law, so long as there's no express preemption. But my question, Professor Eastman, would it make a difference to your theory? It clearly would make a difference to your theory if Congress were to repeal the naturalization laws. Would it make a difference to your theory if they were to pass, a non-binding resolution saying, we think it's a good idea to sometimes let some illegal immigration slide? And the second part of that question is, do you think it would make a difference to your theory if the president issued an executive order or a proclamation saying, I, as the executor of the laws, think it's a good idea to let some illegal immigration slide?
Under Medellin, the presidential formal proclamation or executive order makes it a much closer call. The court doesn't answer that question in Medellin, but it suggests that at least that would be required, and maybe more. If Congress were to pass not a non-binding, let's take it to the next step, a binding. Let's say it's we add a section to the immigration laws that formally delegate non-enforcement authority, broader discretion to the executive as a matter of policy. So that this just is, we no longer like the immigration system we have, and we're just not going to enforce it to the full extent until we get comprehensive immigration reform, which is, I think, what's going on now. But we make the non-enforcement discretion formal part of the congressional policy. I think that might invalidate some provisions of the Arizona statute that make it a separate state law crime to do what is in violation of the federal law, because now you're running counter to that policy. There's a stronger argument for implied preemption there if Congress forgets to add the express preemption clause. But other parts of the Arizona statute I do not think would be affected, and that is the arrest on suspicion of being here illegally to turn over to the feds, where that discretion could then still be exercised consistent with the new federal policy. Well, state court, you know, this is something that hasn't been talked about much, but the constitutional obligation of state courts to give effect to the federal laws is a serious one, and I think that actually strengthens my hand rather than weakens it.
Well, I wish I could agree, but in the Judiciary Act of 1789, you know, talk about your originalism, the first Congress said that civil claims under the laws of the United States, there was concurrent jurisdiction in the state courts. And they said, as to criminal claims, there's exclusive jurisdiction in the federal courts. And that policy has been unchanged since then. The idea that states are invited in any way to help carry out federal laws as federal laws is a mistaken one. States have whatever authority they have under their own police power, but the jealous protection of federal criminal authority has continued since 1789.
I agree with that, but I don't think it fully answers the question. So, the state can't bring a prosecution for violating the federal statute unless they're part of the 287G program, where they are deputized to do that. It's a separate question whether they can pass a parallel state statute criminalizing the exact same conduct that is criminalized by federal law, and then bring the state prosecution. That I think is the most susceptible to constitutional challenge part of SB 1070. But I don't think, because their purpose is a police power one, and they're trying to avoid the federal preemption by creating separate rules, which would be invalid under Hines versus Davidovitz, and this is where the mirror theory that Chris Kobach has put forward is, can I mirror exactly federal law, not to make federal immigration decisions, but to make police power decisions? And I think that's the closest question, and I think the rest of the statutes are clearly valid. That one is a very close call, but I don't think it's as clearly unconstitutional as Judge Bolden thinks it is.
But, John, when I heard you articulating the police power justification, what I heard you was saying that you were trying to, that the state was trying to get rid of undocumented non-citizens. And I acknowledge that they have an interest in that, but that is a regulation of immigration. Their police power, they're trying to shoehorn into a police power justification, essentially driving these people out for no other reason than they want to drive them out. The problem is that they're here.
Yeah, I would characterize it the other way. I would say they're trying to withdraw the delivery of social services to people who are not lawfully here. The collateral impact of that is going to be on immigration, and it's because it's the collateral impact rather than the direct thing that puts it, in my view, into the DeCanis line rather than the Hines versus Davidovitz line.
It looks like we have a question in the back of the room. If the microphone could be brought back there. Thank you.
What effect would it have if, and this is really contrary to fact, but if you had a rule which was enforced in practice saying they would not get any social services? Does that destroy your argument, or would you say that takes care
of it? If I may just interject as a point of fact, Arizona, a couple of years before SB 1070, passed a ballot initiative that denied all social services to undocumented non-citizens other than those required by federal law, and required proof of citizenship or lawful status for things such as driver's licenses, admissions to colleges, and all that. So we have zeroed out, to the extent permissible under the Constitution, social benefits for undocumented non-citizens in Arizona?
Yes. But let me ask this. Is it then, having done that, is it impermissible to find other ways to press that? I mean, you've got huge issues with with identification fraud that undercut the effectiveness of the benefits cutoff. So can we deal with the identification fraud problem by other provisions that accomplish the same thing in the exercise of a police power without crossing the line impermissibly into exercising solely an immigration power. And I think that's the question that is kind of most clearly confronted by this.
And my point is that if we can accomplish that by putting people in prison for being in the United States unlawfully and breathing or walking on the sidewalk or driving in a car, why not just do what the state is trying to do directly and say, we are going to have our own deportation courts, and if you're deportable, we're going to drag you across the border. I mean, I don't see the difference between between saying, if you don't leave, we're going to put you in prison, and we're going to drag you across the border.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess the difference would be one is an exercise of a police power, the exercise and permitted, and the other is an exercise of an immigration power that is assigned to Congress. They have the same effect.
Yeah.
But my goal is the police power goal. We have this all the time.
But the police power goal is the same in both.
Yes, but we're trying to figure out a way to further the police power goal without intruding impermissibly on the plenary power that Congress has over immigration, and avoiding the Hines versus Davidovitz prohibition. And I think they've come up with a way to do it here.
So because this is such a popular topic, I know that Jack has another panel that he has to get to.
Jack, thanks very much.
So unless we have any other questions from the audience, we could take one last quick question. But do we have one last quick question? Okay.
The proposal is not going to have retroactive effect. The bill introduced by Representative King in Congress, like the one that I helped Nathan Deal draft 4 or 5 years ago now, is designed to be prospective only. The reason for that is we have to recognize that over the last 40 or 50 years, when this notion of birth is all you need has taken root, and I think it really has been that recent. You can't find any specific thing before that. And it was more done kind of State Department or you know, what have you, just, you know, kind of policy rather than anything formal. But we have created a reliance interest on that perception, false though the perception may be, and I think it would be untoward of us to try and give it retroactive effect.
Great. So if you guys will all join me, please, in thanking our speakers, one of whom is sent up to us.